Okay, well, thanks for talking to me about terms and conditions.
Thanks of all mine.
Okay, I suppose the first thing I should ask you, and it's an obvious question, but it's worth asking, but if you could tell me about the circumstances that led to your writing it, and what was the impulse?
Well, I've been writing a long time, and I used to write screenplays more. Back in the day, I also produced stuff on the fringe. And I wanted to try and write in a more experimental form. I've previously been rather more kind of structured in the way that I would conceive a story. And I just wanted to kind of try and follow my nose a bit. And I had just an idea, and in itself it's not a wholly original idea. I mean, there are perhaps other examples which you can think of, but of a man in the cellar of a house. Someone being there, I didn't know anything about him, but he was just in the cellar of this house, and it really started from that.
Okay, I see. When you say there are other examples that I might be able to think of, were there any particular influences in there?
Well, he's a kind of, not specifically, he's a kind of shamanistic character, it turns out. This character, it turns out to be from another dimension, and he's a violinist, and it was also I got a bit fixed on the idea of the story of the wandering Jew, who is the one who's supposed to have insulted Jesus on the cross and was condemned to walk through eternity. But he doesn't carry that kind of load, actually. So it's more of the idea is someone who's more. Essentially, he's an outcast, and who's an eternal figure who is out there. And he functions in the play as a kind of an eruption from the unconscious of the leading protagonist. In particular, he erupts into the life, and although bearing goodwill, he actually becomes a source of trouble and strife.
Okay, you've said it turns out that he's a shamanistic figure. Do I take it from the way you phrased that the character was not entirely in your control?
Yeah, well, I was kind of seeking. I mean, of course, you know, it's disingenuous when writers say that something's not in their control. But I was, put it this way, I was trying to exercise as little control over it as possible. And when it starts to come out, and then of course you go back and you shape, maybe, and you make decisions and so on. But as far as possible, yeah, I wanted to kind of be as open ended as possible, I suppose.
And ironically enough, was that a conscious decision then?
Yeah, absolutely. All ironies apply, of course. I think when trying to mind the unconscious, this is a conscious activity, isn't it? So yeah, absolutely. This is the paradox of writing, isn't it?
Indeed. I'd like to ask you some more about Liv, but actually before I ask you that, I'd like to pick up on why you were particularly trying to write in a more unconscious manner and less formal than you had done in the past.
Well, I wanted to I just wanted to experiment with a different way of working. It was partly inspired, actually, by reading Stephen King, who says, you know, that there are no plots in real life, mm-hmm. and that things don't unfold in that way.
This is Stephen King's book
on writing. Okay, that's right. Yeah. So I was quite interested in that, and giving that a go myself. And he talks about all you need is a strong situation at the start. And if the situation is strong enough, then the story will naturally unfold from that. But I wanted to give that a go, and talking about influences, actually, he talks about in that book also. He talks about his muse as well, and his muse, coincidentally, is also a brooding man in the cellar, smoking a cigar. He says, you know, basically, if you work every day, your muse will always be there. And if you don't, the muse, you'll go. You know, when you go down into the figurative cellar, it won't be there. But that actually, I made that discovery subsequently, and that's also going back to what we were talking about a moment ago, was what I meant about the about this figure being a kind of an archetypal figure lurking in the depths. I don't feel I've quite answered like your question quite properly. A more particular answer is that I was interested in. I've been reading a lot of a Slovenian writer called Slavoj Žižek, who's kind of my intellectual guru in some ways, if that doesn't sound too pompous. And it does sound pompous, I know.
So oh, go ahead. But there's nothing wrong with that. We're going
to
go with that.
You know, yeah. We haven't got long to live, so I'll go for it. And he talks a lot about the way that the unconscious works upon us in ways that we don't entirely understand, but in particular in the way that what appears to us as a real world is a kind of ideological chimera. And I was really kind of wanted to try to open myself up to that, to actually exploring these kinds of ideas, and I felt that I couldn't just do that with a conventional structure or even a conventional approach, that I had to sort of have a more open-ended, more dreamlike way of working in order to try to kind of get into a different space.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, you described Liv as an archetypal figure, and I suppose a question which a lot of people are going to ask is Liv a symbol? And if so, what of? I mean, is that a helpful question? I don't know.
I hope he's not a symbol, actually.
Okay,
the ways that I'm sort of relieved to discover in rehearsals is that he's not kind of he's not slipping easily into categories. And I think that is something that I feel he is. He's something that people want to categorise, and the character people in the play want to put him into a pigeonhole, call him a symbol or do whatever. But in actual fact, he is this kind of uncanny excess, which is beyond that control. And so therefore I would say no, he's definitely not a symbol, and I hope that works out, you know.
Okay.
Which is not to say he's without meaning, of course, he's without significance, that actually is that he represents something to them in a more kind of unsettling way. He represents idiocy, actually, in some sense, that actually he's a simpleton who arrives in the lives of people who are highly contriving and want to be controlled. And his what marks him out is his childlikeness and his relationship with money, which he collects purely for the purpose of counting. And I think that he is, as a kind of wandering person, he's looking to find a place where he'll finally find some acceptance. And I think to see whether he does find acceptance, you'll have to come and see the play.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I suppose it's perhaps inevitable that people are going to want to see him as a symbol, and there are certain aspects of him which do lend themselves to that. How important is it that he appears to be Eastern European?
It's not important, I don't think. I think you can go that way with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm trying to keep him uncertain. I think we're still kind of looking at the whole accent thing for him, and the part is written with an accent, or at least written in a kind of in a simplified sort of naive kind of English that he speaks. But that's something that I think is going to emerge from the actor as well. So, but I think that my feeling is that he hails from, certainly perhaps from some kind of shtetl or something like that in Eastern Europe, or perhaps from some kind of ethnic subgroup like the Kurds somewhere, or perhaps even a gypsy, because one of his particular characteristics is the fact that he plays the violin.
Mm-hmm.
And he is actually, as well as being a kind of a reviled figure in the sense where he's come from, because of, you know, he's an outsider, he's also a loved figure, because also he's a violinist, and he winds up teaching violin to the son of the family.
Okay. You've mentioned the Wandering Jew, and you've mentioned the idea that he maybe comes from a shtetl or somewhere like that. You mentioned other places as well. He's also very much in the play associated with Christianity.
Yes.
He takes the son to church, which the parents are, I think it's reasonable to say, ambivalent about. Do you Are you perhaps saying something, or are you intending to say something?
Well, I think the central religion? I'm saying not specifically about Christianity, because that's vague, but and certainly about religion. And I think that the central insight of religion, I think all religions, is that is of the unreality of reality, and that is what I want to explore. Because we in the modern world, we are very confident in our descriptions of reality. And I don't share that confidence. I have, you know, grave doubts about reality.
Okay. Are you in a similar position to people who are trying to find, as in the book, religion for atheists? Are you trying to find what's interesting in religion? Sorry, I don't. Yourself be religious. I don't know. I shouldn't presume.
Well, I am a Catholic, but I'm certainly not. I'm not trying to promote anything like that at all. Not at all. And in fact, I don't believe in atheism either. And I don't. I think that atheists also believe in something, not necessarily a theistic God, but they absolutely believe. I think what most people who call themselves atheists nowadays believe essentially in scientific materialism, plus a bit of, you know, in terms of the Holy Spirit, you know, they with a bit of added that would be in the form of market capitalism, the belief in that this is what infuses and transforms our own life. So I think when people tell me that, you know, that they don't, you know, they don't believe, I think they're merely unaware of their beliefs.
Right. When you say you're a Catholic, does that inform your work, do you think?
It doesn't, except insofar as it does drive forward, as you know, a suspicion that actually the world, what sits in front of us, is not all there is.
Okay.
And a very strong sense with that that I could be drastically wrong. And I think that's one of the things that important insights of religion is to hold, if this doesn't sound too pretentious, that existential experience actually precisely too of both belief and doubt. And after all, it was in one of the Gospels, I think it's St. Mark's, Jesus' final words are, my God, why have you forsaken me? And according to some people, according to Slavoj Žižek, who I mentioned, it, to some degree, that makes Christianity unique as a religion of atheism.
Yeah, Dennis Potter said that Christ couldn't know his own divinity because that would be God cheating. Which I think is quite nice.
Yes.
If Christ knew
yes.
his own divinity, his sacrifice wouldn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Which I think is quite an interesting, theological point.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry,
we're possibly getting off the subject here.
Not really.
Okay. Fair enough.
Perhaps too deeply into it. Yeah.
Okay. You said earlier that Liv is to some extent a manifestation of the unconscious of the main protagonist. I hope I'm not paraphrasing unreasonably. First off, is that a reasonable thing to
it
say?
It is, yeah. He erupts into his unconsciousness.
Okay. Can you unpack that a little bit? What is it about the protagonist that causes this eruption?
Well, he's stressed out. He's moved house. He has got a young family. I think the whole business of kind of keeping up with the Joneses and all of this caused stress on people, and the characters around him all want something out of him as well, you know, be it his wife, his friends who's trying to borrow the money off him, and his son who's not inclined to accept everything that he says, and so ask me another question. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, keep on going. Ask me again. I've lost my
train. No. Well, I suppose what I'm asking is, are you saying anything particular about the state of people in this country, about middle class life in this country? Is this, without wishing to get all Billington on you, is this a state of the nation play in that respect?
I think it can be. I would hesitate to use that expression, because it's not in, if it is, it's not in a conventional way. But I think certainly it is certainly about who we are and how we come to believe in what we are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned the process of rehearsal and finding the accent for Liv. To what extent have you been involved with the rehearsal process and how has that worked, really?
Well, we're still quite at an early stage, but what I do is I'm there as in an advisory role to kind of shed what light I can. My thing is I like writing for actors, I like writing parts that actors can really just kind of let go in, you know, and so I like very much to see them making it their own, and I'm just there to kind of provide any props or sticks that I support that I can on in that journey.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever find yourself surprised in rehearsal?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's the fun of it. There's no greater pleasure I think than sitting down with actors to kind of to do your work, because there's a little bit of a tightrope about it, in the sense that you're never entirely confident that it's going to work, but seeing it staggering into life is a joy, and like watching your own children grow up, you realise that although you had a hand in it, that they are it has an independent force.
Right, I see. You're also a critic. You tell me really, what is it like being both a critic and a playwright? What is the relationship between the two roles?
Well, to me it's completely natural, and I see no conflict. One critic said to me, he said, oh yes, you crossed the divide, which I find quite amusing, because I mean, what divide? There is, as far as I'm concerned, there is no divide. I've never seen this divide, and this is a kind of a mirage that people I think are rather too keen to believe in. It seems an entirely possible and indeed proper for a critic to be a writer if they wanted to be, and people wouldn't be nearly so surprised if a plumber wrote a play, funnily enough, and yet if a critic wants to write a play, it seems peculiar. But as someone who's given a lot his life to the theatre, I think it isn't really surprising, but I've always written. I can't claim to have always enjoyed the success I would have liked, but it's absolutely what I do.
Okay. You said you started writing screenplays more and then moved more towards the theatre. Was there any particular reason? Two questions really. Why film in the first instance, and why theatre more now?
Yeah. Well, what I did was at the time, back in the 90s, I was, I was just trying to carve my way in the world, and trying to make any kind of living on the fringe was difficult, so I decided to write a screenplay. And I noticed, I was looking around my friends, and I noticed that a lot of their lives weren't necessarily going in the intended direction. And so I wrote a script called Mushroom Soup, which is about six blokes going off on a stag weekend, and that got in due course picked up by Sam Mendes, and I developed it with him. And that was a really terrific experience. But in the end, though, he decided to go to follow on another project, which of course won him an Oscar. It's still incomprehensible to me why anyone would do that. But anyway, got me into that. And then I was working on doing the whole thing of working on other scripts and trying to sort of push out projects and so on. And it's a deeply unrewarding exercise, I have to say. There's some financial benefit.
Oh, okay.
From it,
unrewarding, not in the financial sense.
Artistically,
right.
It's because the writers in it can be in the film business have a fairly low status, and getting projects off the ground when you've got such high stakes financially, it's difficult. And actually, this is why I've returned to the theatre, because I think it is possible to do stuff. Mm-hmm. It is possible to explore ideas in a way that you simply cannot do in film and television anymore. There's a lot of good television on the moment, and things kind of maybe shifting there. Mm. But I think given that the stakes are lower in a theatre, you can put on something for a much smaller amount of money. The opportunity to explore dissenting ideas in particular and different modes of expression is is much greater.
Okay, when you say dissenting ideas, dissenting from
Well, from the sort of the there is, of, I mean, needless to say, a kind of consensus, isn't there, around a kind of fairly naturalistic social drama or drama which has a kind of some remedial benefit, or the, of course, the identitarian type of drama, which is very much about kind of the affirmation of certain social groups, and so this is all very much part of a feathering the nest of a kind of liberal humanist, dare I say, ideology that is at large. And I think that if you want to step outside that and actually question the terms of that that ideology and how it structures and fabricates the world that we believe ourselves to be in, then I think, you know, you're going out on a limb.
Okay. I think I've just got two more things I wanted to ask. I noticed you've also adapted The Seagull. You have a script which is an adaptation of Chekhov's The Seagull. Is he a writer you feel a particularly affinity with, or is that a play you feel a particular... Well, obviously it must be, because otherwise you wouldn't do it. So I suppose the question is why.
It is, yeah. Well, it's a play that was very close to my heart. And I just one day I was overwhelmed, really, I think, by an urge to write a modern version of it, because I can help feeling that there's a kind of that there's a sort of there's a preciousness which still surrounds Chekhov, which people are very keen to deny. But I think that the distance in time that we have from him now makes people too comfortable with him. And I don't believe that people were as comfortable with him then as they are now. And I wanted to get back to some of that discomfort in there. And that really meant writing, using that story of The Seagull to write about the theatrical establishment as it is today, and that's a play set in the Lake District, and it's very much about the theatre world rather than about the literary world of pre-revolutionary Russia. So it's very much about, you know, divas and musical directors and so on, and a young playwright indeed in modern Britain, and there. An Oedipal triangle which emerges from that, which is fought more or less to the death. But this is a play that we had on at the reading recently in the print room, and I'm also, as you rightly say, trying to get into production. I'm hoping that will happen next year.
Oh, okay. You use the word discomfort. Is that something you like to produce in your audiences?
A little bit, but not so much so that they actually experience physical pain or anything like that. But,
because it's inevitable.
Yeah, that's true. I like the uncanny, and I like the sense of you get a little shiver up your spine, and I like that that rather than just sort of inhabiting areas that one is that is familiar with, or merely. Kind of groom or stroke, confirm, you know, your sense of self. I mean, for example, I've always preferred having nightmares to having dreams, and of course, this is a kind of perversion which I can only ask to be forgiven for.
Okay, and but the only one other thing I wanted to ask is, what is it particularly about The White Bear? Here we are. Why did you bring it particularly to this theatre?
Well, I mean, in the first place, a very practical reason. I sent the script to Michael, who's someone I've known and liked for many years, and I thought, well, you know, it's just to get some comments on it. And he actually, during the darkest days of after Christmas earlier this year, he said, when I was in the supermarket checking out, wondering if my credit card was going to bounce, that I got a text from him standing in the queue saying that he was really enjoying reading the play. And this is how things get off the ground, isn't
of
it?
Course, but
basically,
yeah.
Things just, you know, connections are made. And that was, I was just hugely grateful, I suppose, to him for just, in the first place, for enjoying the play. And I just thought this would be a really, it's a small theatre, it's the sort of theatre that I would imagine it doing. And I like the idea that you can be in this kind of space just a little bit more subversive than you can be in the larger spaces. And larger spaces that their subversion is subversion, which is performing to certain kinds of agendas and so on. So, and in here you have the freedom just to literally do the kind of show that I wanted to do. And that is, that to me is a beautiful thing.
Okay. Is there anything else you wanted to say that I haven't covered for the benefit of people who may encounter this interview? And
I think the most important things for people to be clear about in all of my rather otherwise ponderous remarks is that this is great fun. People do laugh at it, and it is a bit Kafkaesque. But my take on Kafka, people think, oh, Kafka's all gloom. Kafka used to laugh out loud when he was reading his piece, and I think that there is a lot of laughter in the rehearsal room, and it's fun, and it is, although it has certainly a dark side. I would hesitate to call it a black comedy, and it is, but it's a shall we say a shadowy comedy, but it is funny, and I hope, of course, thought-provoking too. And I think we've got a beautiful design and prospect from Carmen Muick, who's our designer, who was brought in by Simon Usher, who's our director, and hopefully it'll be, you know, a nice spectacle as well. It'll be good to look at, because that's what I enjoy, is that in the theatre, is that, you know, to quote the old tune, to fill up our senses.
That seems like a very nice place to end for me. Okay, thank you.